Welcome to the Ladies of Liverpool podcast.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies.
Ladies of Liverpool.
With Leanne Campbell.
Right, hello, welcome, thank you, all that jazz. I'm Leanne Campbell. This is Ladies of Liverpool, the podcast, and I've been dying to play you this. Sit back, settle down, and don't go anywhere, because this story this week comes from a guy called Billy Moore. Now, he's a local lad of Liverpool. He has a story to tell that all happened in Thailand. It's so explosive, so interesting, so terrifying, it became a movie, and you're going to want to know every single detail. To begin with, though, before all of that, he wants to start right here in Liverpool with his family story. So he's going to talk to you first all about his brother, his autism, and how they've managed to overcome some hurdles. So whether you can relate to a journey about autism or a journey about not quite fitting in, about being led astray, about needing to get away from home, or about choices you've made that you wish you'd made differently, this podcast has it all. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Billy Moore.
Ladies of Liverpool.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies. So growing up then with an autistic brother, what's his name, first of all?
His name's Joe, and he asked me to mention him, by the way. He wanted to come along, but I didn't think it was good for him today.
This is all about Joe.
Yeah.
So Joe, growing up, can you talk us through being the sibling of someone who's autistic?
Yeah, that was like the oldest out of six of us. Joe was like in the middle. He was born, he had lack of oxygen to the brain. This is what we were told him when we were kids.
And
he was different from the other kids. So he was going to different schools, but he was all over the place. You know what I mean? He was very difficult to control.
In an angry way?
I wouldn't say it was like angry at that age. As he's got a lot older, he's become more angry. But I think that's more frustration.
Yeah,
than anything.
Because we've discussed how your memories are of growing up, of your brother, of your Joe smashing the house up or going missing.
Yeah, it wouldn't be like smashing it like in front of everybody. It'd be like you'd wake up and he'd be sitting there in a big load of flour and sugar and everything else, shit the lot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It'd just be all over the kitchen.
Yeah.
All the cupboards would be open. There'd be stuff in the washing machine. It'd just be like a mess, like a bomb site.
Yeah.
My mum would wake up to this every morning.
Plus basically all the other siblings that you've got.
Yeah, yeah. So she'd wake up to this and I could just, she'd be sobbing. She'd be like, you know, he's just like, what's going on with him?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And there wasn't much going on then, was there?
Nah.
To help out with families?
Nah, there was no intervention. There was no people knocking at your door wanting to help, or there was nothing. There was no social media.
Yeah.
You know, it was at that era where there was nothing, like IT-wise.
Yeah. And now you're fully involved in the Rotunda and everything that's going on in the boxing club. So so talk me through your journey with this. You just went along with your Joe, didn't you, to start off?
I was just driving by and I just popped in and it was, I don't know what happened. It was just, I was looking for a boxing club for these two young kids because I was training them in Walton in Goodison Road.
Right.
You know, they lived like close by and these clubs were in the middle. So I knocked at this club, the Rotunda. I noticed that it was an all-inclusive hub. There was kids with autism, you know, that were getting involved. Mm-hmm. And I thought it'd be a great idea for our Joe, you know, to get involved as well. So I could kill two birds with one stone, take these two young kids, train them, plus bring our Joe along and he can get involved. Each week as I took him, he was enjoying it. Mm. Now he's become like a PT for them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's the one who's delivering these training sessions with
That's
these young
brilliant,
kids.
Isn't
yeah,
it?
So this is amazing. And
for self confidence and you know, for him to feel like he's really become a part of a team and part of like a group. That must be priceless.
But it's the guys in there, like Jed Starkey and Liam Starkey, they are absolutely amazing. And I watch them and I observe people because I've grew up, you know, like mistrusting everyone.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way it's been. It's, you know, my life has just been like, you know, don't trust them, don't trust them. You know, you get conditioned to believe that, you know, it's a dog eat dog world. So you've got to be really, really careful. So I was like watching and observing the way things were. And I thought, how amazing these guys were with these young kids.
Yeah.
It was like, it just blew me away. You know, the love and the sincerity that they had for them. It was like, wow, I'm going to bring my Joe along even more. And you know, when it first went along, they made him feel really welcome.
Mm.
They brought him in. They involved him. Hiya, Joe. Nice to meet you. It was none of that dismissing him.
No.
Yeah, as a number.
And is he being used to that, obviously, over the years?
Yeah, yeah. So now
it's breaking that cycle, isn't it? It's making this become the norm, you know, where everything becomes all inclusive.
Yeah.
So you're now there
showing
off what you can do.
Yeah.
And you've got, what, like a team of young lads now that you train?
I've got two young lads who, you know, one of the dads passed away and one feels really insecure. They can't get involved in crowds. They tried the boxing clubs where there's a few and they feel really different and isolated. Yeah. So, you know, I'm a friend of the families and the families have asked me and said, can you bring them along and would you be willing to teach them because they trust you and they feel comfortable in your environment? So I said, yeah, so... They've just been coming along every single week, sometimes twice a week, and they've developed as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's interesting that we're not just talking about, you know, opening this up for, like, anyone suffering with autism or anyone who's affected by autism, but you're opening this up to anyone who's going through any struggle on any scale to become part of a team. Definitely has the benefits, doesn't it?
Yeah, because one of these young kids is, like, quite small. He feels really insecure, very shy, doesn't want to communicate in school, feels like he was getting bullied. This is why his mum asked me what to train him.
Yeah.
Not to be violent.
Not to teach him how to fight.
No, just to defend himself or to grow in confidence. And that's what he's done. You know, I do little video blogs with them over time just so the families could see it. You know what I mean? I'm amazed at how they've developed. I mean, these have come from nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And all those, I'm not by a coach, by a boxing coach by any stretch of the imagination, but I've got a lot of experience. And all I'm doing is giving a little bit to these.
And I think that's what we need to talk about, your life experience and how it's led you to where you are right now.
Ladies of Liverpool.
So where do you want to start? Should we start with your teenage years?
Yeah, growing up, I always wanted to become a boxer, to impress my dad, because he was, you know, he'd boxed. And I don't know, I kind of wanted his acceptance massively and his love and his attention, but never seemed to get it. You know what I mean? He would always be out drinking.
And you thought that being able to fight...
Yeah, because I was never good at football. You know, I'd never get picked for the team. I was one of those kids that always felt different, separate and alone going to school.
Mm-hmm.
I was always put in classes that were like for kids who were naughty, misbehaving. And I don't even know why, because I never really misbehaved. I don't know whether it was just craving attention all over the place.
I read a great little statement of you. So maybe it was the crowd you were running in. But you said in an interview once, if you sit in a barber shop long enough, you're going to get an haircut.
Yeah.
And do you know when something just rings true? I'm like, the young ones today, that is a brilliant saying. Yeah. If you're mixing with a certain group of people, it's a matter of time before it leads you down a certain path.
I'd say it's like bad company corrupts good character.
That's the
one. This is, you know, I'm standing on the corners, Jordan. You know, I went to boxing. I enjoyed boxing. It was my teenage years. It was like, you know, I got a lot of confidence. I was meeting people. I was meeting girls. And I felt a bit, I didn't need me dad by this time. I was like, okay, I'm all right. Yeah. You know, I can stand on my own in this world. You know, and I got introduced to cannabis and, you know, I didn't realise I had a problem with drugs or I had an allergic reaction to them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't break out in lumps and bumps. I break out in handcuffs, pain, misery and loss. I end up in places that I don't want to be and doing things that I don't want to do. It's like my whole kind of like my life is just taken over by something else. It's quite weird. Because I know today that I wouldn't be doing the things which sound a clearer mind what I would be doing under the influence.
Well, you've got to have the clarity to write a book.
Yeah.
And to take, you know, you've been there in Cannes Film Festival celebrating your life as part of a movie with huge stars playing the part of you.
Yeah.
That takes clarity. So we know obviously now you're on a totally different path than what you were on. But what do you reckon you reached a certain low at a young age that got you to Bangkok? Because if you don't know the story, you've got to stay listening to this podcast now as we delve into what happened when you ended up in Thailand.
Yeah, it's like the addiction took a grip, you know, took a hold of me, and he ended up, you know, in a lot of prisons and institutions and lacking in, you know, self-esteem. I had no self-esteem, no self-worth. You know, I was labelled by society due to the way I was behaving in the community. You know, this is the consequences of the way you act. As soon as you get a label put on you, you know, you become that label.
Mm.
Or someone said he's this, he's that. And that's what it became. I was like Mr. Ben. Yeah. You know, I'd adapt. Never allowed to be a kid growing up. This is what I realised when I started writing about my journey. You know, I was never allowed to be that free, loving spirit, you know.
Yeah.
I was the oldest out of six, managing five other siblings while my mum was working and every job that she could get, really. It was quite difficult.
So many will relate to that, listening to this.
No, growing up in that era of, like, being skint and not having no dough and kids are spending the money in the boozes and the bookies and that.
Leaves you angry, it leaves you frustrated.
And that's what he had, a lot of anger. But it was like I was quite passive and it was internalised. You know, it was like, you know, my brother, he's a short fuse, Kevin, you know, and he'd snap like that.
Yeah.
With me, it'd take a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd build up resentments and, you know, you'd have to, like, plug away for a bit. But it's just come out all at once then.
There's always, in any group of siblings, someone has the luxury of being able to be your Kev, being able to fly off the handle. With everyone, if everyone's done that, what would you be like? So one plays one role, one plays another, and it's just which role you slot into, isn't it?
So there's a lot of trauma, really. There's a lot of, like, traumatic experiences growing up.
And you got into the drug side of things.
Yeah.
That led you to... to Walton Nick, didn't it?
Yeah. You know, and it was, I remember it was like 2003, and it was like, just about like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Because you get put in prison, take away the drugs, and then you're awake and you're alive, and then you realise that this is not for you.
Yeah.
You know, there's something within you that goes, look, there's enough's enough now, but how are you going to stop? Who's going to support you? And I remember asking for help, reaching out, and the only kind of support I got was the door was shut.
Mm-hmm.
Someone will come and see you next week, next month, next year. Don't worry about it. So I decided to climb on the roof with a group of lads on the Otter Stadium of the year. And that was just a cry, you know, a cry for help. Needed to, like, get a point across.
Yeah.
I got up, and it was a significant moment in my life. Because when it came down, I got put in solitary confinement. And I phoned my mum up, picked up the phone. And my mum answered immediately. And I said, hello, mum. And she just started sobbing and saying, where are you? You're okay. And just that knowing that someone cared about me.
Yeah.
I had this lump in my throat and I had tears welling up my eyes and I couldn't, I didn't want to blink because I knew they just cascades on my face. And I didn't want to show any kind of weakness. This is what it was. It was all about ego and pride and I didn't want to show any weakness. And she knew, you know what, like mothers do.
Yeah.
She just said, Billy, I know you need help. Just ask for it. And that was the first time something kind of registered to ask for help. So it did. And I reached out, I spoke to the probation officer. They came up and seen me and offered me a rehabilitation.
Right.
First time in my life, you know, you want rehabilitation, I'll have anything, you know what I mean, I'll take anything.
Ladies, all Liverpool. Everything Liverpool. Everything for ladies.
There's never a happy ending, is there? No, no matter what you start on, there's never a happy ending when it comes to drugs.
I started on cannabis and ended up in crack cocaine.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's... And I'm not saying everyone's going to end up...
No.
I mean, they don't. It's just that some people do, and, you know, and that's... It's not a nice experience.
No.
But, you know, how I ended up in Thailand was like, you know, I'd ended up... You know, I was clean. I was in recovery. I started to find a little bit of employment, and I got invited on a 3-month backpacking holiday to Thailand by a friend.
So it was a leisure thing. You were just getting out there.
Yeah.
You were clean the drugs. Your head was sorted.
Yeah.
You're in a good place.
Yeah. So I was in a good place. You know, I sold the idea of, like, you know, the tropics. You know, the people were amazing. The weather was great. The food was absolutely fabulous. So anyway.
Off you went.
Off I went.
And it was the time of your life until?
Yeah, it was the time of that. You know, I don't get me wrong. It was like, you know, I went out there. And after 3 months, my friend said, look, we're heading back. And I went, well, I don't really want to go back. I fell in love with this country by this time. I wanted to learn a new language, adopt a new culture.
Yeah.
Stayed there. I had no kids. I had no ties. So, you know, I kind of just wanted to live and spend a bit more time there. So I got a job teaching English. So I taught English.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I taught English. And then I got another job as Sylvester Stallone stuntman. So I was Stallone stunt standing on Rambo 4.
Wow, what a life though. To this point you go, he's done the best thing ever. But this is the end of the story.
Yeah,
so he just does
this
well.
This is where it becomes glamorous. And not many, when people ask me about what you've done, I go, and I start talking about these little periods in my life, these little experiences, they go, wow, it's quite random, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So away for Stallone, I was in this movie, I was teaching English, I had 50 students, it was quite bizarre. Life was great, and then I met a girl who couldn't speak English, and our relationship was based on a dictionary.
Yeah.
She had a boyfriend, I found out, it broke my heart, couldn't deal with the feelings, and I found myself in the ring, boxing a lot, because I knew that you could put a plaster on a cut and, you know, you could mend a broken arm, but, you know, the internal, emotional heartache that I was going through, you couldn't put a plaster or mend that in that way. So I'd find myself in the ring, and it was like in a way of an escape. You know, I could be myself, and nothing really mattered outside of it. But the more I fought, you know, it's like I said, like sitting in a barbershop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was these rings within bars, surrounded by bars, with girls bringing you drinks.
Come
and
the
stuff
drink,
like that.
Come the booze,
and
come
it,
the
it,
drugs.
It started with a glass of water, to a Red Bull, to a Red Bull and vodka. And then before long, I'm back. I'm smoking this drug called Yabba, which is like a crystal meth.
Oh, right.
Methamphetamine in tablet form.
And I've never heard of that. So was that like a Thai thing? Or?
Yeah, yeah. It's where it all went wrong. It was like, I couldn't deal with the feelings.
Mm.
Because at the end, when the war's over, when the fights are finished, and I'm out the ring, I'm left with myself.
Yeah.
I'm left with the thoughts and all that's going on, all that internal narrative that I'm talking to myself, and this is wrong, and all the resentments and bitterness and heartache, and, you know, is it worth it? And then the fuck it's kicking. Just go and get a drink.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just... But that's where, like, I realised that it doesn't just start with that, it ends with something else.
Yeah. Well, that's where the film starts.
Yeah.
So, Prayer Before Dawn, opening scene, there's you, flat getting raided.
Yeah.
You're getting dragged away in handcuffs. The next thing you know, you're in a Thai jail.
Yeah, yeah.
Ladies of Liverpool.
So life in a Thai jail then, Scouse lad. Standing there, how long were you looking at? What was your sentence?
I had no idea what I was looking at. You know, I was getting told different things by the Thais, like 10 years, 5 years, 3 years, you'll go home.
Yeah.
So there was no hope in believing anything that was getting said.
Yeah. It's the difference between 2 years and 10 years.
Yeah.
Your mental health's going one way or the other, isn't it, with that?
It's just a day in there was difficult. I remember, like, we were marched in with shackles on our ankles that were, like, 3 kilos in weight that were welded on. We had to wear shorts. We couldn't wear long pants, shorts. And you couldn't even wear tops. It was just that hot.
Yeah.
I mean, and I got put into the shell with him. There were 79 inmates. I was the 80th prisoner. I had to sleep on a floor here next to this guy who'd passed away and this ladyboy called Tiffany. And she had this top on that said, no money, no honey. Big bold letters, right, with this little boob tube and these little blue denim hot pants.
So hang on, you're lying there in the middle of the night. You've got a corpse to your right-hand side and you've got a ladyboy to the other side.
It was quite numb. I just arrived.
Yeah.
What I knew from years of experience is I needed to kind of get stuff put in place. I needed a bed.
Mm.
I needed food.
And how'd you go about getting that in a Thai jail?
Well, I spoke to this ladyboy, and it was like, she could speak broken English. And the first thing she said to me is, I love your blue eye. I thought, oh, here we go. I thought, you don't like the brown one, girl. You know what I mean? That one's off limits. And she was going, he's dead, and you can have his masters. And then she was telling me that she told me what I needed to get. And I say yes, she, because she was quite feminine. You know what I mean? Initially, it was like, it was quite difficult to accept where I was, but it was quite quick that I had to kind of like
adjust
get right, adapt to everything really.
Because what you see from the film is, yes, you go into this Thai jail and you overcome everything that's thrown your way,
yeah,
and you end up becoming a professional fighter and you're doing these huge tournaments and you're representing the jail amongst some of the toughest fighters out there. But also it's the fights that go on outside of the jail. At those points, I'll be honest, I had to press pause and go in the kitchen, pour myself a glass of red. It's like, I can't watch it. Can't watch the next bit. What's going to happen to him? Because I didn't know you at that point. I didn't know the end of the story. I thought, he's going to die. You know, the fights that go on outside of the ring. Can you talk to us about that? What were some of the most frightening moments for this Liverpool lad to witness?
See, there was like a battle going on within me. I like to box and I like to get involved in that kind of like control sports. But at the same time, I didn't want to face reality, so I was taking drugs to escape the austerity of the prison. It was quite volatile, it was quite scary, and it was just horrible.
And if you wasted somewhere, surely no one's going to pick a fight with you.
No, for me, it's like, I never had the money to buy the drugs, so I was getting myself in debt with these samurai gangs who were HIV infected.
Yeah.
And they were threatening me with their syringes made out of biros that were full of blood. There was a lot of that, you know, they were threatening me with rape and stuff like that.
How did you get yourself out of that?
These missionaries.
Because you can't even talk the language.
No. I did actually learn to speak Thai, but that was a bad mistake, really, because once you learn how to speak it, you understand what they're saying.
Oh, yeah.
So I knew what they were saying about me. And it was like, here, I sat, I quay, I quay. I thought, these are just... The biggest insult that I got was called a buffalo, I quay.
Is that what they call you?
Yeah. White buffalo. I was like, I've been called worse than that, mate. You know, like, they go, oh, you're very naughty, I call you Buffalo. I go, sound.
I'll take that,
I'll take that all day. I've been called a lot worse. But, it was just, I was in debt. I was subjected to a lot of threats of violence, and I spoke to these missionaries, and I knew that I was going to end up dead because I witnessed this guy getting killed. He'd been stabbed at least 50 times, and it was in front of him. It was like slow motion. It was quite scary. He was a young guy, about 25. He had a bandana on, and he was running past in a pair of flip-flops with some guy running behind him. Someone cut out in front of him, missing with a chair. He hit the deck. And this side was chasing him. I had this knife. I just started. It wasn't even it wasn't even in frenzy. It was like they were all death shots in the neck, in the back, and it was like never ending. And it was like slow motion. It was like quite strange watching it. And I felt guilty briefly for not being able to intervene. But I thought, well, this is not my problem. And I know if I kind of even step in, that'll be me on the floor.
Yeah.
And the inhuman screams coming out of this guy's body was just horrendous. And he just died on the floor there, just in a pool of blood. But what was more frightening was there was a group of inmates surrounding him, screaming, you know, stab him, kill him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And no one intervening. And then they all dispersed.
So where did the guards and everything?
Well, this was it. There was two guards from every 1,000 inmates. So these inmates have dispersed. These two guards have walked over. One's looked at him, kicked him, seen that he was lifeless, and then put him in a cart and got him moved off. And I was like, and then as that's happened, this Thai gang has walked past and they were looking at me and he pointed at me and done that cutting motion across the throat. And I knew it was so easy because they didn't value life.
Yeah.
And I was so frightened and I didn't want to die, period.
Yeah.
But not blood infected virus, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
a slow death sentence. So.
So by then taking part in the tournament and professionally fighting, that got you away.
It's it. But what I had to do is I had to pay them and the missionaries. I begged them and pleaded them because they'd come up once a week to see us. And I said, look, you know, I'm going to end up dead. And they were like, what is it that you want us to do? And I told them that I owed so much money. And he paid. You know, I'm really, really grateful for that.
Yeah.
Because I had nothing. Mm. I had nothing. They paid that debt off and it was then that I had nothing. You know, I had no money for food. I had no money for food anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, I could kind of barter with what I had. And I had to make a change, you know. And at first I was walking around really hungry and I was watching these Muslim guys eating their food and they were looking at me and he invited me along one day. The scouts are kicking in here. So they sat down with him and they went to, this is only for our Muslim brothers, my friend. You know, you're welcome today, you know.
Yeah.
But yes, really for our Muslim friends. So the next day I put a sarong on, a skull cap on, and I changed my name to Yusuf Muhammad. And sat with them, right?
Yeah.
And they were looking at me. They didn't even bat an eyelid.
So again, you're part of a group then, aren't you?
They fed me, right? Yeah. And I said, I'll be here every day. And they went, no, my friend, you've got to move into our cell. So I moved into their cell, and I had to pray 5 times a day. So I learned how to speak Arabic. I was waking up every morning doing a fajr, which is the Islamic call to prayer.
Yeah.
Didn't have a clue what I was saying.
No,
but I could repeat it.
This story is incredible. I could listen to you all day long. Everything you're saying, I'm like, I'm sitting higher up in my seat, wanting to know more and more. And I think if you do want to know the ins and outs or as much as you know you can get, you need to buy the book.
Yeah.
You need to watch the film. So tell us how we can purchase the book.
Amazon.
So you can go on Amazon. A Prayer Before Dawn.
A Prayer Before Dawn.
You've got a new one, haven't you?
Yeah, Surrender from the Heart. This is more of a backstory about growing up. So it's more, it delves into like the post-traumatic kind of growth that affected me as a child. You know, my dad. Because I didn't really have much of a backstory.
No, it just kicks off as you get arrested, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the book sort of brings a little bit briefly.
Mm.
But this one's more about what's happened because I was diagnosed with cancer. I had cancer a couple of years ago. You know, I had stage 3 cancer. I was on chemo. I was 9 stone ringing wet. I was playing my dad in this film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who died of cancer the year before.
Oh, wow.
So the director's like, I got diagnosed on set. In a sense.
Oh my word.
He said, you're playing your father, what would you say to your son? You know, and this was quite, all this was, so that, yeah, and then meningitis straight after it. So I was like, come on, give me.
So much to tell, isn't
there?
And for people who are looking to hear from someone who's been through more than most, really, in one short lifetime. Because how old are you now, Billy?
46.
You're only 46.
Yeah. I think you should
purchase the book. I think you need to find out exactly what went on and tell us your thoughts. You can get in touch with us via all our social media pages, Ladies of Liverpool. Billy, I wish you all the success in the world. And again, Rotunda, can you let everyone know where they need to be?
Yeah.
If they've got a youngster, you need to just let loose in a trained environment with people like yourself who are going to understand.
Yeah, it's Lambeth Road in Kirkdale. It's under ABC. It's the all-inclusive hub and it's on. It starts at half past 10 till about 12 every weekend.
And if you want to contact Billy direct,
you can
always contact him direct via Instagram.
Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, the usual social media sites. It probably won't be difficult to
find him. Give him a follow. Tell him your thoughts about the podcast.
Yeah.
Billy Moore on all social media. Billy, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening.
Subscribe now
via the iTunes Store.
Hear more from the Ladies of Liverpool via ladiesofliverpool.com.